This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour, our week in review. We have our panel of trumpet writers ready to discuss the important events of the week. Here in the studio, we have Robert Morley.
Good to be here. Today, I'd like to talk about a new poll that found that even rich people, many rich people, are having difficulty scraping together even $1,000 to cover an emergency. So we'll talk about why that is.
We also have Anthony Chibadewe.
Greetings. If you remember the news back when the war in Iraq began, some of the big problem causes in that country, well, one of that name is back in the news, and we'll be talking more about him.
We also have Andrew Miller.
Great to be here. Today we're going to be talking about China's gold rush and also the free media in Russia and other mythical creatures.
We also have, via Skype from our office in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon. NATO held its first tank competition since the end of the Cold War this week. America got absolutely thrashed. Find out who won and why it's significant later in the program.
So we are just 1 month away from Britain's referendum on whether to leave the European Union. This was something that Herbert W. Armstrong said decades ago would happen, and we could well see it come to pass shortly. Watching the discussion and the arguments going on in Britain over this issue is pretty fascinating. We're going to start by talking about some of the arguments we're hearing coming out of Britain and that really do recall statements we've been making at the Trumpet for years and that point right back to things that Mr. Armstrong said before us. Naturally, for this story, we're going to go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yeah, one of the best comments on the Brexit and the Britain and the European Union this week came from London's former mayor, Boris Johnson. Now, Boris Johnson has kind of built a career out of appearing to be a complete buffoon. He is very likable. One of the most iconic images is of him stuck halfway down a zip wire in the run-up to the Olympic Games, impotently waving a little plastic Union Jack and having a good laugh about it. But he is actually a very intelligent, a very well-educated man. He went to, I think it was Oxford and Eton. He has or at least private schools, and he's written quite a few books, one of which was on the Roman Empire. And he generated a whole host of headlines all across Europe this week by saying that the European Union is following in the footsteps of Hitler and Napoleon by trying to resurrect the Roman Empire. And so he said, the whole thing began with the Roman Empire. The truth is, in the last couple of thousands of years, it has been broadly repeated attempts by various people or institutions to rediscover the lost childhood of Europe, the golden age of peace and prosperity under the Romans by trying to unify it. Napoleon, Hitler, various people tried this out, and it ended tragically. The EU is an attempt to do this, but by different methods.
How common is this? I mean, this is obviously something that we talk about all the time, and I just don't recall hearing a public figure of his prominence using that terminology with respect to the European Union specifically, that they're trying to reclaim the glory days of the Roman Empire.
Right. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. There are people in Britain who have said this kind of thing before. You had Rodney Atkinson on this show a few weeks back, and I believe he said those kind of things. There are some others in the Eurosceptic movement and within UKIP who will have made similar statements. Adrian Hilton, I think, for example. But they're not household names. They're not high-profile figures. They're not powerful politically. Whereas, you know, Boris, everyone in the country knows him by his first name. He is a very high-profile figure. He is considered one of the top contenders to be Britain's next prime minister. So that's the significance, is that it is coming from someone way higher profile than this analysis usually comes from.
You were a great contributor to a book that we published this past year called The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy, and it essentially documents each of these major resurrections of the Holy Roman Empire. He's pointing back further than just the Holy Roman Empire, back to the days of the Caesars, presumably. But this really is the basic thesis of your book that is being backed up by this British politician.
That's right. And one of the things that really stood out to me in writing and in working on that book is just how easy the research was. And in some ways, there were quite a lot of that book just wrote itself, because you just go to a history book and you almost at random and you open up the chapter on some of these people, on Napoleon, on Charlemagne, even on Hitler. And it's right there in just about every history book that they were trying to resurrect the Roman Empire. And then you go to the European Union, and there's so much symbolism where they tried to appeal to this history, you know, signing key treaties in the city of Aachen, Charlemagne's seat of or main capital. So in some ways, the surprising thing is that more people aren't making this connection, because it is so plain if you just even take a fairly shallow look at the history.
Well, this article that you're talking about, we just have a tidbit in our weekly news report, the Trumpet Weekly. This is a report we produce every week, and you can get it in your email inbox for free. Just visit thetrumpet.com, and we'll be sure that you get that. Another article in this week's edition is "The Fourth Reich is Here." This is a title of an article by Simon Heffer that was published in The Telegraph on Sunday. And here's another prominent British voice in the lead up to the British referendum on the EU, trying to put the whole European project in historical perspective in a way that helps Britons to decide whether this is really something they want to be a part of. Maybe you could just tell us about that.
Right. The headline of his whole article really says it all. The Fourth Reich is here without a shot being fired. And he goes back to an article that he wrote quite a few years ago that I think was even in our Trumpet Weekly all those years ago as well. That where he made this point about how much power Germany had within the European Union, and it has a kind of a Fourth Reich. And he got a lot of flack for writing that article. And then he points out, look, Germany has amassed even more power now. And he's absolutely right. And the interesting thing is, you look at, you know, he was kind of a rare voice back at, I think it was 4 or 5 years ago when he wrote that article. Now you have even Spiegel magazine, Germany's most popular magazine, writing an article saying that, at least in an economic sense, Germany has a Fourth Reich. So, again, that's something that has become quite common knowledge. And so, it's a really good point. And I also thought the way he concluded, talking about how much Germany has won in peacetime and through peace, and has gained even more power than it had and that it was aiming to have through war, was a really powerful one. And that there's some statements in that article that sounded very similar to statements Mr. Armstrong made right at the end of World War II, saying that we don't know how to win the Battle of the Peace, and that Germany is going to end up coming out on top by winning the Battle of the Peace. And now we're at the other end of that, and we can see that exactly that has happened.
Yeah, let me just read one paragraph here. Germany runs Europe without firing a shot. It forces far weaker partners to stay in a currency zone that is crippling them, and uses its economic muscle to dictate immigration and other key policies. And if you believe the Germans won't take a UK vote to stay in as a signal to continue and intensify their control over the EU and to help us to make us help pay for its baleful effects, then you aren't paying attention. It's not war we should fear, but what the Germans do in peace. Of course, if you know the long-term prophetic picture, that's not exactly accurate, but he does make a very good point about just how much Germany has achieved over these through this whole European project. Well, we're going to stay in Britain. Thank you for that report, Richard. But there was a statement from a British military leader that got some press this week. And for this story, we're going to turn to Robert.
Yeah, one of Britain's most well-known generals is warning that military cuts have left Britain unable to fulfill its role on the world stage. That's putting it mildly. He was writing in The Telegraph this past week. This is Sir Richard Sharif. He was the Deputy Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. So this is someone whose voice carries a fairly significant amount of weight. And he said that Britain had become semi-pacifist under David Cameron. And basically he charged that Britain was more worried about things like welfare and benefits and welcoming immigrants and things along those lines than defending the nation and providing adequate defense for the nation. And he said that Britain is at the point where there have been so much in terms of military cuts that it risked losing its ability to even fight wars overseas, and that its reputation that it had won back during the Falklands war was basically gone.
So what is it about, are there any statements that he's made where he's making charges that we haven't heard? You know, this is obviously a story that we've followed for quite a while, quite so many years, as we've watched Britain decline as a global power, as a military power. What is it that he's adding to that?
Well, if you pay any attention to the UK and even how the United States refers to the UK, a lot of times we've heard President Obama make statements like, oh, the UK punches above its weight class and things like that. He came out and basically said that is a bunch of garbage. He said any talk that Britain is punching above its weight class is an illusion. And he was just very, very strong. He said, you know, Britain used to be famous for walking softly and carrying a big stick, alluding back to those words of Roosevelt. And now he said that Britain has leadership that shouts loudly, but thanks to the defense cuts, carries an increasingly tiny and impotent stick. So there's just some pretty strong words. And I think it's backed up by the facts on the ground, because if you take a look at Britain's military today, it really is shrinking. So for example, Con Coughlin, he was writing in the Spectator last November, he said that military insiders were warning that Britain had lost a third of its capabilities over the last 5 years. So this is massive, massive drawdown we're talking about. Chatham House, they came out and said that the UK troop numbers have been cut so severely that the army might not even have the personnel to use a lot of these military platforms that they are purchasing that will be delivered in the future. So they're talking about things like the new aircraft carrier that is supposed to be delivered in 2020. They're saying that by the time that aircraft carrier arrives, our troop drawdowns at that point will be so low, we won't even be able to effectively use that. One of the examples they gave was in the army. And right now, the British Army is less than 100,000 personnel, and it's set to fall to about 82,000. And this is a report, and they said that those numbers put it on pace to be the smallest British army since the Napoleonic Wars. So since the late 1700s, Britain army, population way bigger today, but just going back to the way it was a couple of hundred years ago. So pretty much everywhere you look in Britain's military today, they're facing cuts. Even its famous Trident nuclear deterrent, its submarines. They have four submarines, and a report recently came out, actually I think it was last year, came out saying that at any time one of those submarines is in dry dock being repaired, and often there's two in dry dock being repaired. That leaves two other ones, one that's on patrol and one who's preparing to go out on patrol. So Britain's nuclear deterrent really is about one submarine at a time, which is a fraction of what it used to be in the past. So we are seeing some dramatic changes in a military and a navy that was once considered par excellence, the number one army and navy, or at least navy, the number one navy in the world. And we're seeing some big changes to that.
First, it's not Chatham House, it's Chatham House.
We have our British pronunciation expert here, Roger.
Priorities in your article about how Britain prioritizes all these other spendings ahead of the military. And you see that exactly in the cuts that have been happening over the last few years. You know, after 2008 and the financial crisis, Britain had to make a bunch of choices, and they chose to drastically cut the military. Meanwhile, spending on healthcare has been protected and quote-unquote ring-fenced. So has spending on things like pensions. Welfare has been cut, but so many of these other bigger areas haven't. And so you see that exact those mismatched priorities reflected exactly in how the government is spending its money.
Yeah, here again, this is something that Herbert Armstrong talked about decades ago and said that this was going to happen. And he talked about it quite a bit in his pillar book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. That's another book that you can get for free at thetrumpet.com. But describing, even at the peak of Britain's power, the biblical prophecies that explained how it was going to lose that preeminence, if Mr. Armstrong saw headlines like the ones that you're describing today, in one sense, wouldn't be surprised at all because it's exactly what he said was going to happen. Well, thanks for that report, Robert. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. One of the big concerns that this British general had was what's happening in Russia. And we're going to go now to Russia and look at yet another story among several we've been following in recent weeks and months, showing how the Russian president is cementing his hold on power. So was it a fairy tale that you were going to tell us about? For this, we're going to go to Andrew.
Yeah, I was going to say I'm challenging myself right now to try to make the biggest understatement of the entire Trumpet Hour segment today. But so here goes. It's like it says, for the last 16 years, the free media in Russia has had a pretty tough go of it.
Oh, that's true.
True
statement.
It's true.
But more evidence of that emerged this week.
Right. I mean, since Putin came to power in 2002, I mean, journalists in Russia who oppose his policies have had an annoying habit of just dying under mysterious conditions. And Putin's just really bullied any media organization that opposes him into where he's pretty much at this point controls the entire Russian media except for one organization, and that changed this week. The RBC is a Russian media outlet run by Mikhail Prokhorov, who was actually a candidate for president in 2012. Didn't do well, got like 8%, but no one does well in Russian elections against Putin. But he ran this news agency, and he had like three of his top journalists just recently did a pretty hit editorial piece on Putin's palace. It's this huge resort on the coast of the Black Sea he uses to meet with world leaders. It's like his personal castle, which he's built with state funds. And so they're trying to make a little bit of a scandal out of that until finally just this week, all three of those journalists were fired from this agency that was considered the last free bastion of Russia's free media.
They stepped over the line.
I mean, they're trying to pull it off that they did some minor company misdemeanor that meant that he needed to fire his three best journalists. But just last month, they had Russian police like searching Prokhorov's house, looking for any evidence of anything he said against Putin. One of his best friends was shot a couple years ago for running a presidential campaign against Putin. So the pressure's been on him, and pretty much any Western media outlets really seeing this as, okay, yeah, this guy's had his friend shot. He's had his house ransacked. He's the last guy who has anyone writing against Putin, and now he's fired his three top journalists who just wrote an article against Putin. It's easy to put two and two together that Putin's just really clamped down on this last media outlet, or even though he doesn't necessarily own every media outlet in Russia, although the Russian government does sponsor and own many of the main media outlets, even the ones he doesn't own are now sufficiently bullied that you can say that there really is no free media left in the Russian Federation.
Well, would there be any backlash to this type of thing? We've talked, I guess the last time I checked, President Putin's approval ratings were still amazingly high, according to, well, those media reports from the state-controlled
That's
media.
That's what, who's the chess guy who was always against Putin?
Kasparov,
right. Yeah, that's what he says. I saw an interview with him a couple years ago. They're like, well, Putin's approval ratings are really high. He's like, how would you know? He owns all the media outlets. Putin's approval ratings are whatever Putin says they are.
But there are some in Russia who are unhappy with this kind of strongman tactic.
Right. I mean, the indication, even though Putin does get like usually like 60, 70, 80% approval ratings, I mean, I think like election watchers, even though he won 60% of the vote in the last election, most of them agree that he padded that by only about 10%. So there are definitely about half the people in Russia who are very supportive of Putin and probably doesn't mind that he's taking a stronger hand, making sure that there's no Western or free influence in the media. But but there is definitely another half of people who are probably upset by this. Although, I mean, it's they're probably kind of cynical and sad to say. I'd almost be surprised if we saw any backlash. I think like I said, with people being shot and people's houses being ransacked, I think the half the people who are opposed to this have kind of learned their lesson that they just need to shut up.
Yeah. But. Well, Vladimir Putin, definitely a man to be reckoned with. We've drawn a lot of attention to him. Our editor-in-chief in particular, Gerald Fleury, written quite a lot about his place in biblical prophecy and just how important he has been in overseeing the revival of this Russian empire that will play quite a dramatic role in end-time events. His articles, you can, if you just search for those articles on Vladimir Putin on thetrumpet.com, you can really get a lot of education about why he is a man to watch. Well, we have one more story before the break. An Egypt airplane, Flight 804, has gone down. It looks like it could be another act of terrorism for an already battered Egypt. And to tell us about this, we're going to turn to Anthony.
Yes, this was the biggest story, I would say, of this week coming from the Middle East. And it is a sad story, really. This plane crashed. It was flying from Paris to Cairo, and it crashed into the Mediterranean about 180 miles from the shoreline. It was an Airbus A320 with 56 passengers and 10 crew on board. Now, the biggest question has been, was this plane downed by terrorists? And it seems like we might be finding out some of those answers very soon, because this morning we heard reports from the Egyptian military saying that they found body parts, they found passenger belongings and parts of the aircraft pretty close to the suspected crash site. But from the beginning, when we got news about this this incident, from the beginning, many authorities were saying that the chances that it's a terrorist attack are higher than the chances of it being a technical problem. And I'm sure you know that a lot of times analysts, especially early on when a story is developing, they are very circumspect about how they word these things. But early on, they were suspecting that it's a terrorist attack.
Well, a couple of recent events that kind of would have thrown suspicion in that direction.
Yes.
Just in the last couple of years.
Yes. The Islamic State has been responsible for a terrorist attack. They bombed a plane that was coming from Russia. It was a Russian plane, and it exploded over the Sinai Peninsula in October. So there are a lot of reasons for people to worry about this. And another thing is that this plane, like I said, it was coming from Paris, but it made two stops in North Africa, one in Tunisia and one in Eritrea. And these are terrorist hotspots. So we don't know what could have happened. And I guess we'll be finding out soon. The FBI is a little cautious about it. It says that it doesn't have any evidence of a terrorist attack yet, but that doesn't mean that it couldn't be a terrorist attack.
But this could really have significant ramifications for Egypt's president.
Yeah, that's the most important thing. So I think for now is that whether it's a terrorist attack or not, this is a big problem for Egypt, especially for the president al-Sisi, because a lot of people are just losing confidence in al-Sisi. They don't believe he's capable of solving all these terrorist problems. You've had a lot of these terrorist attacks, especially in the Sinai Peninsula. There is a branch of the Islamic State that's flourishing in the Sinai, and that's a big problem for al-Sisi. Just with his political rule. But then there's another aspect about Egypt that's really important to note as well. We have an article in the Trumpet Weekly from Brent Noctegal and Callum Wood, and it talks about some of the economic ramifications of this attack. Egypt is a country that's heavily dependent on tourism, and this unfortunate incident is not going to help the tourist industry. In fact, just looking in the recent past, when that Russian plane was attacked, Russia canceled all flights in and out of Sinai because of that. And that cost Egypt $250 million in revenue per month just because of that. And Britain pretty much did the same thing. And with now another problem happening in Egypt, you can be sure that the tourism industry is not looking good in Egypt. And there's a point that is made in the article that you'll find in the Trumpet Weekly, and it's a very, very profound point. It says this towards the end. Recent history shows that Egyptian governments do not do well when the economy falters. That's what happened with Mohamed Morsi, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood president. People didn't topple him because of his Islamist ideas. He was toppled because of the economy. So that's the big problem. And if this attack affects the Egyptian economy, which it definitely will, we can expect more uprisings against Al-Sisi's rule, and we can see is Egypt turning more radical through this whole process.
It does put a lot of pressure on President Sisi. He's already got a lot of pressure on him, but just more and more evidence that we're likely to see another change in government. And obviously, that's something that we've been forecasting for Egypt for a while, knowing that the indication in biblical prophecies that there will be an alignment between Egypt and Iran. And that would require quite a considerable change from President Sisi, for sure. Well, thanks for that, Anthony. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about intrigue in the Iraqi parliament, the Chinese-Russian gold rush, what Americans would do if they had an unexpected $1,000 emergency, and how America was beaten in a tank battle. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Well, let's talk about this tank battle. You don't hear much about tank battles these days, but this is actually a training exercise. But to tell us about it and about the outcome, we're going to go back to Britain and we'll hear from Richard Palmer.
You're right. You don't hear about these battles much. This is the first time that NATO has held this type of tank competition since the end of the Cold War. This was a type of warfare that was kind of meant to be obsolete. And the return of this type of contest just by itself is significant. It shows NATO is going back to training for mass tank battles with Russia. But the disturbing part of this is that America wasn't very good. It failed to place in this battle. It didn't finish in first, second, or third. Doing badly in one tank competition isn't necessarily a huge piece of news by itself, but it shows something that is profoundly worrying. America has spent the last decade or more configuring its military around fighting terrorists. And it looks very strongly that it's lost a lot of skills that revolve around fighting other major powers. And this focus on fighting terrorists has caused skills that would be necessary to fight a nation like Russia to really atrophy. We have an article from Popular Mechanics in the Trumpet Weekly this week, and in that article they write that the result raises the question of whether the army, after more than a decade of focusing on guerrilla warfare, has devoted adequate training to address big war skills. They quote the army chief of staff, Mark Miley. He wrote in the New York Times recently that today a major in the army knows nothing but fighting terrorists and guerrillas because he came into the army after 9/11. But as we get into the higher end threats, our skills have atrophied over the last 15 years. And they also give the example of another tank competition that they held, that the American military held this year. And they write that a tank crew consisting of an insurance adjuster, a Pepsi truck driver, college student, and aspiring police officer beat 15 other reserve and active duty tank crews to place first. So there's a lot of evidence that America's tank warfare and ability there has decayed over the last 10, 15 years.
You know, this is interesting story as part of a larger trend. We've just finished the July edition of the Trumpet, the print edition, and you, Richard, have an article in there about America's military and its supposed invincibility. A lot of people like to quote the expenditure of the United States military relative to the rest of the world. It spends an enormous amount of money, and yet there is so much evidence of why you can't equate military spending with military prowess and military power and might in the way in the real world, and the way that it would be activated on the battlefield. This is yet, you know, that article really focuses on waste and graft and just the amount of misspending of that all of that money. This is another aspect of this, and that is, what are we training for? What sorts of threats are we really devoting our resources to? And is it really something that's going to be of value in today's warfare?
Absolutely. And I think I do want to write another article on this subject, because it is a huge deal. Just to give one quick example, America has spent a vast amount of money developing a gun that can fire around corners. And that it's pretty impressive. That's absolutely great when it comes to fighting these other guys that fire around corners. I mean, that hide behind rocks and things, so you can shoot them without being able to see them. How valuable would that something like that be, though, when it comes to fighting Russia or fighting China or a major power? I'm sure it would still be helpful. But meanwhile, at the same time, over the past month or so, you've had a lot of people right at the top of the army saying America is getting left behind on key areas of technology, that actually they're getting left behind by Russia, by China, because America's been focusing on guns that can fire around corners for fighting insurgents. Meanwhile, these other nations have been focusing on things like hypersonic missiles, which is an amazing technological development that actually it looks like Russia and China are ahead of the United States on. And so that they're getting left behind when America is widely considered the most technologically superior armed force in the world.
Right. So much of whether or not that technological superiority is effective depends on whether you're imagining the threats as they actually are. If you're preparing for threats that don't exist, or you're preparing for threats that are less important or less threatening than others that you're not preparing for, then you're in a whole lot of trouble, aren't you?
That's right. And the other part of this tank battle story that I'd just like to make sure we get in before we move on is who won. Because the interesting thing is it was Germany came in first place, and then Poland and Denmark filled the next two places. And actually all three of those were using the German Leopard 2 tank. And the Popular Mechanics article makes the point that these countries, it seems clear, have not neglected things like training with tanks and these big war skills. So Europe hasn't been kind of sidetracked by this secondary threat of Islamic terrorism in quite the same way that America has. And I think that's a really interesting result there.
Not all that surprising, considering that they're in Russia's shadow, and particularly mm-hmm. Poland, that they're so concerned about what moves Russia has been making recently, that they would be a whole lot more urgent about that kind of military training than America sitting safely across the Atlantic. Well, thank you for that story, Richard. We appreciate you bringing that to us. We're going to go back now to the Middle East. Ever since the Gulf War in 2003 eliminated Saddam Hussein from Iraq, this nation has been in various stages of chaos. So the fact that there is more chaos there isn't necessarily news, but it's a nation that we watch closely at the Trumpet because of the way we expect it to come under the control of Iran. That's the indication in biblical prophecy. And to bring us up to speed with how that might be moving closer to fulfillment, we're going to go now to Anthony Chibadewe.
Iraq's Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi, he's staunchly pro-Iran. In fact, his very first state visit was to Iran. So already Iran has a lot of control in Iraq. But this Prime Minister al-Abadi, he has been trying to reform the parliament in Iraq for a number of reasons, which I'll get to a little later. But he's not the only one who wants cabinet reform. A few weeks ago, we had a lot of thousands of people, Iraqis, on the streets protesting against al-Abadi, and they protesting for this reform, thousands of them, and a lot of them were supporters of the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. We'll try to talk more about him, but this is a name that a lot of people will remember from back when the war in Iraq began, back under the Bush administration. In fact, we wrote extensively about him and about his connections to Iran. Now, al-Sadr and his supporters, they want this cabinet reform because right now it's endemically corrupt. They want a cabinet reform that gets rid of all the corruption in the country. And another thing that they want to reform is the quota system in the parliament right now, where you have pretty much every sect in Iraq represented in parliament. Now, al-Sadr and his supporters are calling for an end to that. So you have more of the prominent groups in Iraq taking over most of the power in that country. So that's what he's calling for. And
he's a Shiite, and Shiism is obviously a majority of Iraqis. So it would give him a whole lot more power if they went away from that kind of representative system.
Definitely. It's almost a reversal of all the gains that have been made in Iraq so far, if you can call them gains, because after Saddam Hussein was toppled, Iraq has been trying to accommodate a lot more different groups. The Shiites have been the more prominent group.
They suffered considerably under Saddam Hussein's rule.
Yes, they did. And just an interesting fact, Muqtada al-Sadr's father was killed by Saddam Hussein's regime. So they suffered a lot. And when they toppled Saddam, this was their opportunity to fight back, I guess, for revenge. But then they instituted this quota system where it wasn't just Shiites who were in power or who were represented in parliament. There are all these different groups who were represented. But now al-Sadr wants to get rid of all the smaller groups being represented, and that will automatically leave the Shiites with a lot of the power there in Iraq. Now, about this al-Sadr, like I said, he has a lot of ties to Iran. We wrote about it. If you go back to our May 2004 trumpet, you will find his face on the cover. And in that article, we talk about Iran's strategy for conquest in Iraq. And he was instrumental in that. He fought against the United States forces in Iraq early on in 2004. He was the one primarily responsible for the carnage. In that country, he has an army. It's called the Sadr Army, and it is about 50,000 soldiers in that army that caused a lot of the problems there. Then he got into shortly after that, he got involved in the Iraq government under al-Maliki. He supported al-Maliki when he was put in power in Iraq. But then he got into a lot of trouble because he continued targeting U.S. forces. So he got in trouble. The United States issued a warrant of arrest for al-Sadr. And guess what happened to al-Sadr? He sought refuge in Iran. And Iran took him. So he has been in Iran for about 4 years, but he came back essentially when the United States officially withdrew from Iraq in 2011. Sadr saw that this was his opportunity to come back, and he came back. He promised that he would be more of a politician this time around. But now, as we see, he is back in politics. He has these supporters who are calling for this cabinet reform. So whatever happens in Iraq, it's not good. He is a Shiite. He's a staunchly Shiite. And that doesn't move Iraq away from Iran. In fact, it might just move Iraq closer to Iran.
Certainly a man that Iran would have no problem seeing take more power in Iraq. Well, thanks, Anthony. You are listening to Trumpet Hour Week in Review. We are going to finish the show today with a couple of economic stories, starting with one out of Asia. And for this, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, for the past 2 years especially, there's just been like this huge gold rush among central bankers across the world, with central banks buying up something like 2,700 tons of gold. But that gold rush hasn't been very widely distributed amongst all the world's several banks. As a matter of fact, 85% of those purchases have all been made on the part of Russia and China, with each nation buying about 1,000 tons apiece in the past couple years. And Largely, that's this has taken off of since the invasion of Russian invasion of Crimea. You know, they put Western sanctions on Russia. One of Putin's chief economic advisors at the time had even suggested that he said if we're going to achieve our objectives in Ukraine, we don't have the power yet to undermine the United States militarily. He said the only thing we can do is to undermine the United States economically, which means we have to go after the dollar's status as the global reserve currency, try to convince more nations to do like bilateral currency exchanges in their own currencies instead of changing to dollars before they buy goods in other nations, and try to diversify our holdings into gold. And this is, I've actually got a quote here from Sputnik News, which is one of those news agencies I referred to earlier that's completely owned by the Russian government. You've got to be careful taking what they say. But in this context, using Sputnik News is definitely going to be a very good reflection of what the Russian government wants their people to think. And they were bringing the point that they brought out a couple of the other nations that were buying coal were Kazakhstan and Belarus. So he said it's mainly nations in the Eurasian Union or in the China's New Silk Road program. He said, that our objective is that we're really trying to build, and this is almost a quote, I don't have the exact quote, but this is almost a quote. He said, we're trying to make all of Eurasia, all pretty much the entire Asian continent, a united economic zone with backed up by gold reserves.
And essentially aimed directly at trying to undermine America's economic dominance.
Right. I mean, I think that can definitely be said of both nations. China's usually a little more politically correct in finding other ways to phrase that. But if you're looking like Russian advisors, they're usually, a lot of them are very honest that like, no, we want to take down America's economic dominance. We can't do it militarily. So the dollar's status at the reserve currency is what we've got to be gunning at.
How big a threat is this, Robert?
Well, I think it's very, very interesting. I think that something else that didn't get as much headline and that Andrew hasn't mentioned that's also significant is just looking what other non-Russian, non-Chinese central banks are doing. Because if you go back to 2009, ever since the end of the Bretton Woods economic meetings, the world central banks, the Western central banks, have been net sellers of gold. They've been selling off the gold and they've been buying dollars, and dollars replace gold as the world's reserve currency. But around 2009, that changed. And what we saw in even central banks in Europe, central banks considered part of the US centric Western financial system, they stopped selling their gold. They all reached a point where suddenly in 2009, they were no longer selling gold and buying dollars anymore. And I think that's very, very interesting, because even America's allies now aren't dumping the gold and buying the dollars the way that they used to be doing that. And I think it's interesting also because, I mean, what do central banks need gold for? Like, don't they all have printing presses? Can't they just go out there and print up more money? I mean, that's an interesting question. Why would these central banks be buying gold? I thought that it was just this barbaric relic, this thing that's useless. I mean, that's what we've been, for the last 30 years, everybody's been told, buy U.S. dollars, sell the gold, because there's no role for gold anymore. Well, now, as Andrew brought out, that started to change. So then suddenly even the Europeans stopped selling their gold, and now we're starting to see even the Europeans start to pick up. We saw Germany just recently, last year, say, we want our gold back from America. You've been holding our gold since the end of World War II. We want it back on our soil. So we're starting to see a lot of these moves where central banks, even the central banks that should be just fully embracing dollars or euros or these fiat currencies, now going back to hard assets, something that can't be printed, something that can't be created in infinite amounts by the click of a button. And your question as to how much of a threat is this? I do think this is a very significant threat for America long term. I don't know when we'll see, we'll see the effects of that hitting the U.S. dollar. But you can just look at the value of the U.S. dollar throughout its history, and it has been falling. It's been one continuous slide of the U.S. dollar. And I think it's at the point where America's most important trade partners, as well as its enemies, see that as a problem, and they are preparing themselves for a post-dollar world.
They do see which way the wind is blowing, for sure. And these foreign powers that want to undermine America economically. There's a lot of indications that it shouldn't be all that difficult. Obviously, a lot of indicators of the American economy as a whole that show that it's not in the greatest of health. But you actually brought a story to us this week about individual economic or financial health that is quite troublesome for Americans.
Yeah, there was a new poll out by the Associated Press, and this poll found that two-thirds of U.S. adults would struggle to cover a $1,000 emergency. So two-thirds of households in the United States, if they were hit by an unexpected emergency of some kind, health emergency, vehicle breaks down, whatever it is, they would struggle to find $1,000. And I think this is very significant because, you know, we've been fed this narrative that the economy has been recovering. We're back on this road to recovery. You know, we're starting to generate more jobs and, you know, the unemployment rate is falling. But when we take a look at people's personal finances, what we're seeing is that for many Americans, that has not happened. And even in higher income Americans as well, which would be on the opposite of what you would expect. This poll, for example, found that, you know, not only could, well, they found that three quarters of households that made less than $50,000 a year would have difficulty coming up with $1,000. So that's people making less than $50,000. But what about people that make, say, $50,000 to $100,000 a year? Well, they found that still two-thirds of those people within up to making up to $100,000 a year would have difficulty coming up with $1,000 to cover an unexpected bill. And even people making up to the top 20% of Americans, they looked at the top 20%, people making over $100,000 a year, and of those 38% said they'd have difficulty coming up with $1,000. So what we're seeing is no matter how much money people make, there's an incredibly large proportion of people that just spend more money. You make more money, you just spend more money. And these are people that for whatever reason, and the poll gets into a little bit of that, are having difficulty saving money and covering their expenses.
You know, it's not terribly surprising. It really seems like a reflection of exactly what you see in the highest leaders of the land, the kind of mentality that they have. They're really prioritizing short-term gain and putting themselves in a hole in the long term. And there's really a lack of imagination. There's a failure to recognize the seriousness of potential threats and just how easy it would be for catastrophe to strike. You know, you look at, say, on the national scale, how much a tiny bump in the interest rate would just decimate the entire economy. And you have the same kind of a failure to recognize those problems on the individual level. Just I was just thinking as you were talking how it seems like the whole premise of this election cycle is that we have this class of leaders, the 1%, you know, that if we can just get these people out of office and we can put, you know, one of us in these positions of power, that we would be able to turn this thing around. But really, the people are beholden to the same kinds of problems and limitations and traps of human nature that the leaders are. And this is really very tangible evidence of just the fact that we're all in the same boat together and we're making the same mistakes. Well, thank you for that, Robert. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories that we talk about on The Trumpet Hour Week in Review, we jam them all into The Trumpet Weekly, and you can read them and a whole lot more if you get this publication every week. It's free. You can receive it in your email inbox every Friday. Well, speaking of a whole lot more stories, we are going to finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. We'll try to jam as many of those as we can into the last few minutes of the program, and that is coming up next.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
It's time for our lightning round. We're going to take one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention, and we'll begin with Andrew.
Well, harassing U.S. planes and ships seems to be a national pastime these days. We covered a few weeks ago about Russia, two Russian planes buzzing American ship in the Baltic Sea. Well, now a couple of Chinese planes did the exact same thing to some American planes in the South China Sea.
All right, we'll go next to Robert.
Well, North Korea has finally weighed in on the U.S. elections. And who does Kim Jong-un and North Korea wish would be the next president? Well, we find out today that North Korea doesn't care whether it's Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, as long as they do not work to suppress North Korea.
Okay, we'll go now to Richard.
Austria is going to hold the final round of its presidential elections this weekend. We spoke about the first round of those elections a few weeks ago. They could be very significant. The polls show that Norbert Hofer, a man from a fringe right-wing party, often referred to as being far right, is headed for victory. If he wins and Austria elects this far-right president, as he's usually considered, that will be a political earthquake for all of Europe.
And now over to Anthony.
The Iranian parliament said on Wednesday that the United States should pay Iran reparations for 63 years of, quote, spiritual and material damage.
All right, we'll go now to Andrew.
Yeah, well, Russian President Vladimir Putin may have said he's withdrawing from Syria, but we now have reports that the Russian military is still constructing a huge army base in the central Syrian city of Palmyra. Allegedly, the base will be used to protect significant archaeological sites from the Islamic State.
All right, we'll go next to Robert.
Well, Eric Fanning was sworn in as a U.S. Army secretary this week in Washington. He is the first openly homosexual leader of a U.S. military service.
All right, we'll go back to Andrew.
Well, the death penalty may be on its way back to the Philippines. The new president-elect of the Philippine country has got a tough record on crime. He's now saying he's giving security forces the power to shoot to kill organized crime. And it looks like the death penalty, up into including hanging, may be back in the Philippines soon.
Did you have another one, Anthony?
Yes. House Representative Randy Forbes told the United States public that if information being withheld by the Obama administration about the sailors that were captured by Iranians, if that information was made public, the United States would be shocked.
All right, we'll go back to Richard.
The sale of small arms has exploded in Bavaria. What's referred to as small arms here by the Bavarian government are guns sold for self-defense, but they only fire blanks, so they're just designed to intimidate attackers. In 2014, 2,400 people applied for licenses for these type of guns. In 2015, that more than doubled to 5,750. In February, that number was 7,500. So in just 1 month, far more than the previous year. And then in March, that number was around 4,700. So this shows there's a real increase in fear within Bavaria and probably throughout Germany. People are so fearful that they're looking to arm themselves in some way.
And Robert, do you have one more?
Sure. U.S. unfunded pension costs hit $1 trillion or almost $1 trillion in 2013. So that's a cost owed by states in unfunded pension to retirees, and then they also have another $587 billion in healthcare liabilities that they didn't fund. So a lot of money we've been promising that we haven't put away.
All right, we'll finish with Andrew.
Report released last Friday revealed that China's actually built up now to 3,200 acres of new man-made islands in the South China Sea. This is a huge story that just looks like it could totally transform the way maritime trade works in the world. Though I'll leave you on a bit of a cliffhanger here, because this is actually the cover story of our next Trumpet. So if you want to find out the details about how this is going to change the world, I'd encourage you to subscribe to the print edition if you haven't already.
Well done, Andrew. All right, I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. You can receive a free subscription to that magazine that Andrew just referenced, the Philadelphia Trumpet. It's a monthly news magazine. It's a beautiful magazine, very informative and excellent, excellent publication. You can also receive our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly, that has all of the stories that we talked about on the program today. You can also tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Robert Morley, Andrew Miller, Anthony Chabadirwe, and Richard Palmer.
Thanks for having me here.
Good to be here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. I'll leave you with the words of Aristotle. We praise a man who feels angry on the right grounds and against the right persons and also in the right manner at the right moment and for the right length of time. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.